Members of the House Elections Committee will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum. If we do, we can make things more official. We have two bills today on the agenda. I think we'll start first with Representative Bernardi's bill, House File 576. Representative Bernardi?
Oh, sorry. Yep. I was helping with the chairs. Sorry.
It's all right. Thanks, Representative Bernardi. We can't yet formally move your bill, but why don't you just describe the bill and we'll take any testimony.
I just left something at my chair. Excuse me for just a moment.
No, that's all right.
Okay. I left my document over at my desk. Oh, well. Okay, well, so, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 576 and refer it on to the Government Finance Committee.
Go ahead.
Okay, so go ahead. I am, this bill, to give you a little bit of background, it's supposed to help with receiving money to the state and make that system less cumbersome, and then also help to enhance the Safe at Home project. So currently, the Secretary of State has authority to raise funds from outside sources, but needs to go to the Legislative Advisory Committee when the legislature is not in session to have them appropriated to the office. This process is time-consuming and cumbersome and has resulted in delays in projects. For example, a federal grant for improvements for military and overseas voters would have been available to the state in late December 2011, but the state did not receive the legislative authorization until late March 2012, allowing the office to provide the enhanced services for the general election, but not the primary. The other portion of the bill for Safe at Home is currently the Secretary of State does not have program authority to accept funds for the Safe at Home address confidentiality program. There has been times when program participants are so grateful for the benefits the program provides that they have wanted to make a small financial contribution to the program. They had to be. It was explained to them that they could not make that they could make a contribution to the state, but the process involves filling out several forms, and that it was unclear whether the contribution would go into the state's general fund or to the program. In each case, they decided not to contribute after all. In addition, it's likely that the program would be eligible to receive grants from the federal government or charitable foundations to expand its reach or enhance its services. However, there is currently no authority to even apply for these opportunities. It would be beneficial for the office to be able to apply for grants and accept contributions, especially if they didn't have to go through the Legislative Advisory Committee process to have them appropriated. So that is my testimony. Take questions.
Ms. Fraser, do you wish to be heard on the bill?
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman, and Representative Bernardi, and Ms. Fraser. So who do you propose to ask for funds from? Who would you solicit?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, I think that primarily we would be looking at federal grants, potentially grants from charitable foundations. For example, the Pew Charitable Trust provided a grant several years ago that paid for the automatic address updates, saving the state several hundred thousand dollars that we were able to use those charitable funds for, and potentially from local units of government. I know that there are enhancements that local units would like to see, and in the past, at times, local governments have provided funds to the state for enhancements they wanted.
Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how much money are we talking about needing? I would guess it varies, but is there a kind of an average amount that you run short? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I don't think it's necessarily about running short. I think it's a question of if there are opportunities, for example, for a federal grant like there was in the last year to provide enhanced services to military and overseas voters. We want to be able to apply for that and receive the funds in a timely fashion so that we can support military and overseas voters. If there were a federal grant for address confidentiality programs like Safe at Home that could help us expand the services or provide better education to entities with whom participants interact, we would like to be able to apply for that and use the funds in a timely way. And if there were some sort of functionality that the local units of government wanted us to be able to provide, but we didn't have the base funding to be able to provide, we would want to be able to work with them to add that.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Frazier, so thank you for that explanation. I think it clarifies a little bit for me that, again, it's not so much running short. It's helping you to access federal funding and other funding more easily. Is that
yes, Mr. Chair. And Representative Erdahl, yes.
That's okay. You can do that. It's fine with me.
Happy numbers.
Yes.
Representative Erdahl, is that any more questions? Okay. Any other member questions or comments? Go ahead. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, to me it's written a little vague. You're talking about trying to obtain some federal grants and maybe some funds from local governments, but whether just written as soliciting funds, that could mean from anybody. For me, I think this needs to be more specific on where these funds would be solicited from. I think that would clear up a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Frazier, given what you testified to, so you've talked about local governments, you've talked about foundations. Any other category?
Mr. Chair, the federal government.
Oh, and the federal government, sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think that you're right, that this isn't written as precisely as perhaps it needs to be. And when I talked to House Council about it yesterday, there were some questions about exactly how it was written, and they wanted to consult with more of the fiscal staff who would have a better idea about exactly how it should be written and if there were other sections of statute that needed to be referenced. And since this is going to one of the finance divisions, the thought was that perhaps those changes could be made there since that's really their focus anyway. But I do hear the concerns about where we would be soliciting funds from.
Representative Johnson. No? Representative Dowd?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my concern is very similar to Representative Johnson's. I think this gives me a little heartburn without kind of defining a little more closely where the sources could come from. And I think it makes sense. I don't have any issue with that. But just opening it up, I think, to any source, I think maybe provides just a little bit of heartburn. So is the intent to maybe refine this at another stop, or do you want to hold it over, Mr. Chairman? What are we thinking?
I'll tell you, Representative Dowd, I think it does need to be refined. I think that's reasonable. I actually sit on the next committee to which it's going, and I can, and so does Representative Bernardi, that's right, on State Government Finance, Representative Murphy's committee, and I think we must, in that committee, unless we did something on the fly here, which was very easy, that we could do by oral amendment, I don't know that we'd want to do that unless someone can write now categories. I suppose, I'm just noodling on this, we could say from governmental entity or nonprofit foundation or something like that. But given, Ms. Frazier, that you said some people with House Research, I presume, have some comments, maybe we should wait. So it's my intention, I think it would be fair to move it to the next stop, not just to move things out for the sake of it, but because that is probably the committee where, with the benefit of the nonpartisan fiscal analyst, we can put some matters into it. And I'm happy to consult, Representative Dowd, with you or with our lead, who I know isn't here today, Representative Sanders, since it is within our purview to make sure that it doesn't leave that committee unless there's satisfactory language. Language satisfactory to you and others.
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative O'Driscoll also sits on both committees, and he and I discussed this issue a little bit this morning as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
I appreciate that, and I don't have a problem with that. If you want to move it on to the next committee and with a you know, mm-hmm. kind of general agreement that maybe it needs a little more refining to define what exactly the source of the funds may be. I certainly appreciate that. I'd also like to look a little bit at the exempting it from the gift statutes as well, and just make sure that that's appropriate. But I think maybe I just need to process that in my own mind.
Fair enough.
And is that, maybe I'll ask Ms. Frazier if that's, did you have discussions with the research staff about that or the revisor's office about if that's the appropriate, that's necessary to do in this case?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dowd, we had very brief conversations, and they were actually pointing to some other statutes as well that we may need to be exempted from. Like, there's another statute that actually relates to federal funds. So there may be some other statutes, but we will work with the fiscal staff to figure out exactly what needs to be referenced and be sure to share any draft language with, you know, the interested parties ahead of time so that everyone can feel comfortable with.
Ms. Frazier, I think that would be wise. I think that a particular amendment, it would be good if, you know, even beyond 24 hours, yes, to share it with either Representative Sanders or Dowd or others, mm-hmm. Who have questions, just so everyone has ample notice beyond the minimal required.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I think that alleviates some of the concerns that I was trying to get at as well earlier in my line of questioning. Keeping it to governmental grants, I think, would be the best. I really don't want to see you and Secretary Ritchie going door-to-door selling cookies or something.
I'd like to see it.
First thing,
Rodgers. Well, I was just going to say maybe we could use it as a fundraising technique for other areas.
Sure. Any other member comments, questions, or concerns? Is there any? If not, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Bernardi renews her motion that House File 576 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Our second bill today, there he is, Representative Lesh. It's Representative Lesh's bill, House File 526. And as you're getting situated, Representative Lesh, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the minutes, committee minutes from February 19th.
All in favor of approving the February 19th committee meeting minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Lesh, welcome to the committee. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it pleases the chair, I'd have Mr. Davies here explain the bill.
Judge Davies, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairman, members of the committee. This is a bill that has deep roots in Minnesota. In 2004, one of the Minnesota electors, either through senility, deafness, or confusion, voted for John Edwards for president. So Minnesota was responsible for the one electoral vote that John Edwards got for president. Well, the Minnesota legislature was appropriately upset by that and passed a bill to provide for alternate electors who would take the place of any elector who did something as stupid as that again. After Minnesota passed the law, the Uniform Laws Commission, at my urging, took up the subject matter. And they not only took up the Minnesota subject matter, they took up the main theme of that Minnesota Act, which was that alternates would be named and would be available if any elector from Minnesota again did something as stupid as vote for John Edwards for president. And so the remedy in the Uniform Act, which we have before you today, is taken from Minnesota law. Now, as is typical with the Uniform Laws Commission, it dotted I's and crossed T's that in the haste of the Minnesota Act we've neglected to do. There are three of them that I think are worth mentioning. One is that the electors were, upon being chosen, were required to take a pledge to vote the way they were elected to vote. And so that provided in Section 8 of the bill. In Section 9 and in Section 12, there is a tip of the hat or a recognition of an obligation under the U.S. Code to submit the names of electors and so on. And that had never been covered by Minnesota law, but had been followed, of course. And in Section 11B, there is a recognition of a constitutional provision that has to be or should appropriately be dealt with, and that is that the U.S. Constitution says the electors shall cast their vote. Well, what we did in the Uniform Act was define cast so that it was when the appropriate vote was accepted, then that was what would be considered a vote that was cast. And other than that, that's what the bill does. Now, why are we here? The main reason we're here with the bill is that it's of interest to Minnesota what happens with electoral votes in other states. And we've dealt with the Minnesota problem effectively, but we would like the Uniform Act passed across the whole country. And as you can well recognize, you need a little momentum to pass Uniform Acts in various legislatures. And so we'd like to have Minnesota recorded as a Uniform Faithful Electors Act state in order to help us pass the bill in other states. That's the story.
Judge Davies and Representative Lesher, I know that there's an amendment to this bill, if I understand correctly. It's on its way down. I think it was inadvertently left out of packets, so Mr. Geldman's getting it. Changes a couple technical things, but before we get to that, and as we're waiting to that, I'm wondering, does this law say anything? Well, let me back up. A few years ago, if any of you know Jeff Greenfield, TV reporter, political reporter, formerly with ABC, then CNN, in his spare time he writes books and even novels, and he wrote a book, kind of a political thriller, a few years ago called The People's Choice, I think that's what it was called, where the story was, what happens if the person who wins the presidential election dies before the Electoral College meets, and that was the situation. Would this at all affect that? Does it specify what would happen?
In the drafting of the Uniform Act, we talked about that and decided it was such deep water that we should avoid that particular issue, assuming that by act of the National Committee of the Democrats or the Republicans, that would somehow or other be taken care of.
Okay. And I just have a question. I see the amendment's on its way, but Judge Davies, so if you had a recurrence of the situation in 2004 where one of the electors wanted to vote for someone who wasn't even on the general election ballot, like whatever the equivalent of John Edwards would be, someone who was not the major party or any party nominee, what would happen here? Would that person's vote be nullified in favor of the alternate?
All the votes would be examined by the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State would reject one that was not appropriately cast, if it was blank or voted for somebody else, or if somebody just refused to submit their ballot. And in that case, the alternate elector for that elector would be substituted as the elector. You'd be interested in the national story. There are about six states now that have administrative remedies for the problem of a faithless elector, somebody who votes wrong. But only the six states deal with it. And that's what we take care of in this act, as the Minnesota law already does.
So, Judge Davies, just so I understand, of Minnesota's 10 electoral votes, in the situation where someone voted as the person did in 2004, we wouldn't have 9. We would still have 10, right? We're not. I know that vote would be invalidated, but then the alternate would vote sort of the right way, so to speak, right?
We don't give up any electoral votes.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Judge Davies, Representative Lesh. Just wondering, what is entailed in the oath that one takes when one becomes an elector? Is it a written oath? Is it a verbal oath? What is the oath?
Under the Uniform Act, Representative Erdahl, under the Act, each elector takes a pledge, and if they violate that pledge, then they're ousted.
Mr. But I could read the words of the pledge starting on 3.19, Representative Erdahl. If selected for the position of an elector, I agree to serve and to mark my ballot for president and vice president for the nominees for those offices of the party that nominated me. If selected for the position of elector as a nominee of an unaffiliated presidential candidate, I agree to serve and to mark my ballots for that candidate and for that candidate's vice presidential running mate. That's the pledge.
So this is something you just raise your hand and read that or say that? Is that how it works?
Judge Davies.
I think the you could do it that way, or it might be written, a written pledge. Okay.
Mr. Chair, has anyone here been an elector? Nope.
I was almost an elector once, but I didn't get off the dime quick enough.
Members, right, we do have the A1 amendment before us, and so I'll move the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, one caveat to the A1 amendment.
Sure.
Line 1.4, actually page 4, line 16, has two ands, so it should specify the second and, not the first one.
Mr. Guerin, could you tell us how properly to modify the amendment? We'll take it as a modification, I take it, and not an amendment to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I think you could just incorporate that change into the A1, so it'd read on line 1.4 of the A1 amendment, page 4, line 16, delete the second and insert A.
Okay, so we'll just incorporate that into the amendment. Anyone wishing to speak to the amendment? Representative Lesh or Judge David?
It's, Mr. Chair, this is mostly technical, other than the line 1.2. Of course, we have 10 electors, as pointed out by Ms. Frazier to me yesterday, not 8. So it removes that error of 8 and correctly verifies the number of electors we have, which is 10.
Okay. Any member comments, questions, or concerns as to the amendment? Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Lesh, you just bring up a very good point, changing from 8 to 10. Would that be better crafted as electorates assigned to the state so that we don't have to go back every time that we have reapportionment and have to worry about the up and down on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, I don't know the right answer to that because I don't know all the other places where that number is specified in statute. You might be right, but because we are apportioned electors based upon federal law, it might be appropriate to do that in all sections of statute. I just don't know where those are.
And actually, I see that the amendment, right, that the amendment as written would get rid of any number on line 1.2 of the amendment. And instead of just saying the names of 8 alternate presidential electors, it would say the names of persons nominated as alternate presidential electors. It gets the number out of there completely as I read it.
So maybe I misunderstood your question, Representative O'Driscoll, but yes, it does that.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, thank you. It was just that we would not have a codified number in statute to create a conflict if apportionment happened and the legislature wasn't able to address it or it was an oversight, that we would, for lack of a better term, not create a constitutional crisis in the state of Minnesota.
I think the amendment appears to take care of that. Judge Davies.
And I will go up to the reviser and ask the reviser to do a search and put into the reviser's corrective bill correction of anywhere else that it appears.
Judge Davies, if it appears anywhere else, we hope not. Any other member comments, questions, concerns? Anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay, if not, then... Oh, I'm sorry, we need to put the... all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? You say no. Amendment prevails. Now to the bill, unless there's any other testimony, comments, questions, concerns. I'll renew my motion that House File 526, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesch and Judge Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, that is it for today. The meeting is adjourned.